Hello and welcome to More or Less, your weekly guide to the numbers all around us, in the news and in life. This week, statistics about sepsis. Is the condition twice as bad as we thought, or half as bad as it used to be, or possibly both? A celebrity loyal listener has a question for us about gun violence. And is there a
global sleep loss epidemic,
as a leading expert has claimed? But first,
everyone is delighted with the new profile, ma'am, which they feel to be an elegant reflection of Her Majesty's transition from young woman to
old bet,
settled sovereign.
For some of our loyal listeners, Netflix is no longer an innocent pleasure. And no, I'm not alluding to Netflix and chill. I am talking about the planet. And it seems that you're racked with guilt over the environmental impact of your streaming video habit. Here, for example, is an email from Harriet.
Can it be true that watching 30 minutes of Netflix is equivalent to driving for 4 miles?
Thank you, Harriet. Good question. We paused our own Netflix viewing to look into this.
One just has to get on with it.
The claim was made in an article on a website called Big Think. It says,
apparently, watching a half-hour show would cause emissions equivalent to 1.6 kilograms of carbon dioxide. That's also like driving 3.9 miles.
In other words, the old days when you used to drive over to Blockbuster to rent a video were actually less damaging to the planet than streaming the video over the intertubes. But Harriet wonders whether that can really be true. And so do we. I shall have to use our largest scales. We started by asking Simon Evans of Carbon Brief about the claim that 1.6 kilograms of carbon dioxide is the equivalent of driving nearly 4 miles. He said, nope, more like 8 miles, unless you have a real clunker. So the comparison between driving around and streaming video is even worse than Big Think say. Unless, of course, the claim that half an hour of video streaming generates 1.6 kilograms of carbon dioxide is completely wrong. Is it? That claim came to Big Think from a French think tank called The Shift Project, which describes itself as a non-profit advocating the shift to a post-carbon economy. So we've turned to one of the world's leading experts on the effects of information technology on the environment, Jonathan Coomey.
These numbers are far higher than what I would expect. We've studied the electricity use of internet downloads for a long time, and in 2018, we published a peer-reviewed article that described the trend over time in that electricity intensity. Basically, every 2 years, the electricity intensity halves. And so when you have changes that are this rapid, it's incumbent upon people who make such claims to be extremely careful in how they do this analysis. Because even being off by a year or two can have a huge impact on the end result.
It makes sense. I suppose 20 years ago, I was using a modem to access, I certainly wasn't streaming video over it, but downloading things off the internet, and the modem would sit there and the modem would get warm, but I would just be downloading a few kilobytes, not gigabytes. Do you think that they have got it wrong then because they have been using out-of-date data? Is it that simple?
That's part of it. I think they relied upon an analysis. It's a kind of high-level analysis of the aggregate electricity used by computing equipment. And that analysis includes a lot of things in the calculation that when you're strictly doing an analysis of video, you would not include. And so, for example, in normal data centers, there's all sorts of equipment that's there for storage and for networking and for computing that have very little to do with how Netflix actually streams their movies. And it turns out that for these kind of companies, they use what's called a content distribution network. But what the people who have studied this over the years have found is that those servers that stream the movies are vastly more efficient than normal internet data centers. And they can stream, one server can stream 200 different streams to 200 different houses and use very little electricity to do it.
Did they get the carbon intensity of the electricity grid right?
know, and this is something that's a little puzzling. I dug into their estimated electricity intensity, and the one that they used was supposed to represent the average emissions intensity of electricity for the world in 2018.
So that would be, what, a mix of nuclear and renewables and gas and oil and coal and all the different ways we generate electricity, some of which produce a lot of carbon dioxide and some of which don't.
That's correct. And so on average, you would expect the electricity grid to have an emissions intensity that was less than that of a coal plant. And the emissions factor that I found that they used was about twice that of a coal plant.
How can you be worse than a coal plant?
On average, there's no way that it can be worse than a coal plant. But that's a factor of two right there. But then, you know, on the other side, you have much bigger factors affecting the electricity intensity of the downloads. For the network electricity use, I found that they overestimated by a factor of 40.
But a factor of 40?
Yes, sir. And so a factor of two is obviously big, but a factor of 40 makes your eyes open wide.
So if the impact of streaming half an hour of video isn't 1.6 kilograms of CO2, then what is it?
Less than 20 grams.
That doesn't sound that bad.
It isn't that much.
So if I happen to want to watch a movie tonight, you would encourage me to relax and enjoy myself?
Exactly. Exactly right.
Jonathan Kumi. By the way, other streaming video services are available, including from the BBC, and Jonathan Kumi told me that they all use similar technology and similar infrastructure, so the environmental impact is likely to be pretty much the same, regardless of which streaming service you use. You're listening to More or Less, and if you fancy subscribing to our podcast, I'm willing to bet the carbon footprint of that will be even less than streaming video. The most comprehensive study of sepsis around the world has found that the condition is killing 11 million people a year. We'll come back to exactly what sepsis is in a moment, but first, let's talk about that new research. Dr. Christina Rudd of the University of Pittsburgh led the project. She reckons that the number of victims is twice the previous estimate.
I've seen this with my own eyes, and my colleagues that are on the ground treating patients in low and middle income countries every day have been saying this for years, that this is a major problem. And so, in a way, I wasn't actually that surprised. On the other hand, I didn't expect it to be double the previous estimate.
So what explains this doubling?
Previous research did take into account all available data at that time, but unfortunately, most of those data came from high-income countries like the UK, the United States, and often it excluded children. It focused only on adults, and sometimes there were a few studies on very young children, newborns only. And additionally, the previous studies only focused on patients that made it to the hospital. So we now know that actually, when you use data that comes from all over the world, you find that there's this massive burden, especially in low or middle income countries and among children. And I think that this is really what was driving our estimates to be so much greater than the leading previous estimate.
Dr. Christina Rudd, that doubling of cases is a big jump. So as with many medical conditions, it's wise to get a second opinion. We got ours from Mervyn Singer, a professor of intensive care medicine at University College London. First, I asked him, what is sepsis?
Sepsis is essentially where the body goes haywire in response to an infection. So rather than the normal immune and other processes dealing with the infection, which happens the vast majority of the time, for whatever reason, still don't fully understand it, you get this dysregulated, exaggerated response that leads to the patient becoming systemically unwell and the organs becoming dysfunctional, failing. And clearly, when more than one organ fails, that's called multi-organ failure. And clearly, that can then put the patients in an intensive care unit and or at very high risk of dying.
One member of the More or Less team had an elderly relative who was in hospital for a long time, poor quality of life, and then passed away, and pneumonia was blamed. And pneumonia, I think, used to be called the old man's friend. It used to be this idea that pneumonia is the thing that carries people away at the end of their life. We were wondering, might that actually have been sepsis? Might a lot of cases that are called pneumonia actually be sepsis? Mm.
So again, it's just simply a matter of definition. So pneumonia equals chest infection. A chest infection that results in respiratory failure, lung failure, is then by definition sepsis.
So what do you make of this report?
I think although it's been a worthy attempt by the group who published the paper to come up with statistics, again, you have to query the face validity, the plausibility of some of the data. So, for example, mortality rates, without being too disrespectful to some of the countries I'm going to mention and their healthcare systems, but the United States is on a par with Albania. The UK is on a par with Kazakhstan. Qatar is allegedly, if you believe the data, seven times better than the UK in terms of mortality rate from sepsis. So the general view that, yes, sepsis is a bigger problem in Africa than it is in the UK is absolutely right, but the actual veracity of the data, I think, can be challenged. One of the points of that paper, which unfortunately hasn't been highlighted by the media attention it's brought, is the fact that using the same metrics, the same way of analysing the data, they've suggested that since 1990, there's been a 30% drop in the incidence globally and a 50% reduction in mortality.
Right. So it's twice as bad as we thought it was, but it's also half as bad as it used to be.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And, yeah. And do you accept that broad trend? Do you think that the problem is improving?
Yes, I think so. I don't work in Central Africa or wherever. But again, talking to colleagues of mine who do work there, they say the infrastructure is improving. It's still not perfect by any means, but there are now huge efforts on vaccination, trying to improve sanitation, hygiene, nutrition. And all of these factors are hugely important in preventing disease, preventing illness, preventing infection.
And there seems to be a long way to go in the UK as well, judging by tweets from the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. He said a few months ago on Twitter that I think there were 52,000 deaths from sepsis and every death was a preventable tragedy. Are deaths from sepsis in the UK mostly preventable?
No, absolutely not. You know, no, I can give a categorical no to that. Again, looking at data, and this is data produced by NHS England, the vast majority, so over 75% of patients who die of an infection-related illness are 75 years and above.
Yeah, I was looking at the data, and as far as I could figure out, the number of people who die from sepsis under the age of 75 is fewer than the number of people who die from sepsis over the age of 90. Mm. So, and this is very clearly, you do hear of these cases of teenagers dying of sepsis. Absolutely. Young children dying of sepsis does happen, but does seem to be very much an illness of the over 80s.
Yeah, oh, very much so. A lot of these patients have underlying illnesses, comorbidities. You know, they're coming towards the end of their natural life, and it's just a fact of life. We all have to die of something sometime.
Yeah.
And some of these people will go on to survive, and unfortunately some of these people, usually those with underlying severe illnesses, cancer, severe heart disease, severe kidney disease, severe lung disease, often they don't have the reserve to get them through this acute illness.
Professor Mervyn Singer. You're listening to More or Less. And if you have any questions about nonsensical numbers or suspect statistics, contact us at moreorless@bbc.co.uk. Oh, look who's appeared. It's the best-selling author, Bill Bryson. Bill, what are you doing here?
I'm very happy to be here. I've come to talk to you about gun violence in my native country.
Oh, gosh. OK, well, that seems rather serious. So what has provoked questions about gun violence?
Well, it's obviously an ongoing issue in America, and there's no sense that it will ever be resolved in any way. But it's very hard to get to the bottom of what the truth of having guns is a protective thing and how much of it is it causes more violence.
Yeah.
And then I saw this a reference in the Wall Street Journal that I sent you.
Yes.
That just seemed to me a spectacularly dubious claim.
Yes. So I have the claim. It was published on the 22nd of October 2019 in a column by John Lott, who's an economist who's, I think, quite politically active and writes a lot about guns. And what he said was, strict gun control laws and high homicide rates often go together. If you look across all countries, or all developed countries, the ones with the highest gun ownership rates tend to have the lowest homicide rates and the lowest murder rates for mass shootings. So you find this implausible?
Well, it does seem a little counterintuitive, at the very least, that the more guns you have, the more likely there is to be violence, I would have thought.
Yes.
So I would love to know on what he based that and if there is actually any truth in it. It's so hard to know what to believe.
I promise you, Bill, we are going to look into this and perhaps I can give you a phone call and tell you what we found and get your response to it. Would that be okay?
That would be fantastic. I would love to hear more.
Bill, while you're here...
That's an ominous ring to it.
No, don't worry. But, you know, you've got a book out, The Body.
Thank you for mentioning
it. And, well, I mention it because one of our loyal listeners has a question. His name is Martin Goodhue, and he quotes you as saying, if you laid all the DNA in your body end to end, it would stretch 10 billion miles beyond the orbit of Pluto. And Martin wrote to moreorless@bbc.co.uk, this is a pretty astounding thought, but is it true? Bill.
Well, we have 2 meters of DNA in every cell in our body, strictly speaking, every nucleated cell, not so you don't have it in your red blood cells. But you have so many cells in your body, 37.2 trillion, they think, that means that you have an awful lot of DNA. It is beyond my brain's ability to comprehend just having 2 meters of DNA in a single cell,
yeah.
Never mind having, you know, a whole body full of it. But the fact is, and it is, I accept, a truly astounding fact. I think it was probably the most astounding fact I came across in doing the research for the book, is that because we have so much DNA in every cell and so many cells, that if you took it all and formed it into a single fine strand, it would be enough to reach from here to beyond Pluto. Which is, to me, I just thought, that can't be true. I mean, when I read it, I thought, that can't be true. There can't be enough of me to reach Pluto.
Yeah.
That's just...
I mean, we should point out Pluto is actually a lot further away than people tend to think, right? I mean, it's really very, very far away. We think of bodies like, you know, the Moon and Mars and so on. Pluto's way out.
Yeah. But, so, I checked it out as carefully as I could. I cannot independently verify.
You've never done this. Are you saying you have never actually taken
all the DNA?
I cannot
do the computation. I could try to compute it, but I'm so... unmathematical.
Our producer Neil Rozell is here. I'm sure he would volunteer his body
but what
to
I did
science.
Was I checked it pretty scrupulously because I just couldn't believe, and it does seem, it's either spectacularly wrong and repeated all over the place, or it is correct.
Well, we've had a look, and to reassure you, we think you are probably right. But so
it has certainly been repeated a lot in respectable places.
Yeah.
And the basic point here was, with that and some other facts that I bring up in the book, is that, you know, the human body is the most immensely complex thing. And, you know, we all inhabit this space. We all live in this sack of tissue for all these decades and really take it completely for granted. But it is what it is doing for you, just in keeping you upright and moving around and enjoying life and, you know, having enriching experiences such as we're having right now is really quite miraculous.
Bill Bryson. We will look into his question about gun violence and have an answer for him and you next week. Now. Sleep. We love it. We need it. But whether you're a new parent being woken through the night, or a teenager roused too early for school every day, or even just a hard-working radio presenter trying to hit one book deadline too many, you might feel you're not getting enough of it. Many people do. That is why there's a whole industry of sleep experts. And among the most popular is...
Matt Walker!
Neuroscientist and best-selling author Matthew Walker.
Professor Matthew Walker joins us now.
His book, Why We Sleep, became an international bestseller in 2017.
Thank you very much.
The book reached Moscow.
A lot of my friends were reading it, and they were all recommended it.
That's Alexei Guzi, an independent researcher with a background in economics.
And I figured, well, since this book seems to make such a big impact on a lot of my friends, maybe I should read it and maybe I should learn more about how to sleep well and why we sleep.
He got reading and noticed what he thought were mistakes. So he checked them out and wrote up his findings on his blog. and there do seem to be some claims worth investigating. First, here's Professor Matthew Walker on Good Morning Britain.
There is a global sleep loss epidemic, and I wish those were my own words, but they are the words of the World Health Organization.
The claim is in the book too. Search online and it comes up in various newspapers and websites, many linking to each other. Search for the original source, however, and you'll find what Alexei found.
This appears to be false. They never declared any sleep loss epidemics.
We checked, and indeed the World Health Organization told us they had made no such declaration. So we asked Matthew Walker to explain himself. He said he'd misremembered. A respected organization did sound the alarm, but it wasn't the WHO. It was the US Centers for Disease Control, which says that sleep disorders are so pervasive in the United States that they now constitute a public health epidemic.
And that was also verified by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. The attribution of that should not be to the World Health Organization, and so that misattribution needs to be corrected in the book.
So he's put his hand up on that one. What about the other claims?
Walker wrote that the shorter you sleep, the shorter your lifespan.
Matthew Walker uses almost those exact words in his book. The shorter your sleep, he writes, the shorter your life. Alexei argues that it's more complicated because there are also studies that show an association between a shorter lifespan and longer amounts of sleep. According to this research, sleeping 8 hours and sleeping 4 hours has the same impact. Both have a higher risk of a shorter life.
It seems to contradict what Walker writes, where he says that higher sleep is always associated with lower mortality.
Professor Walker acknowledges these findings.
Can we get too much sleep? And the book actually goes on to speak about that. I think that may be possible. But I also don't think that should be necessarily surprising, because it seems to be the case for the other three main critical ingredients of life, food, oxygen, and water. Can you overeat? Can you undereat? So does sleep follow that same U-shaped function? It does seem to, in terms of mortality risk.
Matthew Walker says it's important to note that these findings about the link between sleep duration and longevity come from population studies, not clinical trials. In other words, we're talking about correlation rather than causation. And what does that mean? Well, if you're sleeping 10 hours a night or 4 hours a night, perhaps that might damage your health, but maybe the causation goes the other way. If you have a serious health problem that's exhausting, so you sleep a lot, or it's painful and it keeps waking you. The unusual sleep patterns are correlated with your illness, but they don't cause the illness. It's the other way around. How much sleep should you be getting? The National Health Service recommends between 6 and 9 hours a night for adults. The US Centers for Disease Control and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine suggest 7 hours. Of course, I am not a doctor, so please don't rely on a radio program for medical advice. And that, loyal listeners, is how we know the world is banana-shaped. It seems like a good place to end. I hope we didn't put you to sleep. If we did, from me and the rest of the More or Less team, bye-bye.